to Shattering Myths. It's my pleasure to turn our attention to, you know, someone who can be trusted, someone whose offer is reliable. Before we jump back into his presentation of his covenant and Bereshith, the first book of the Torah, I received a long letter from an individual today that shares his journey from religion to relationship, or at least to exposure of what the relationship with God is like, back temporarily to religion, and then finally out of religion into a pseudo-debate with his former pastor. And while I can't share any of the details with you now, I've asked the author of the man who lived the experience for approval to share it with you. Between now and I get it, I just want to share the pastor's response, and I'm not actually going to, in this program, get into any details of the pastor's response, but I will in a future program, if I get the approval to share this. But what the pastor is basically saying is that it is appropriate to believe what you read in the Christian New Testament, particularly Paul's letters, and that it is irrelevant that what Paul writes is wholly destructive, critical of, demeaning of, negating of Yahweh's Torah. And so you have to deal with two issues that that Christians don't seem to be willing to grapple with. One is a God who would say one thing in his Torah and then allegedly inspire an individual to say the opposite thing someplace else is schizophrenic. That's a God who is a complete hypocrite. That God is no different than the kind of men that lead us off into war.
Yeah, and of course, this is also not just what he said in his Torah, although this is the most important. There are witness writings from people like Yael Conan and Matanyahu, mm-hmm. and Shimon, mm-hmm. and they say the opposite of Paul.
Well, Yosha's testimony is that, yeah.
That walk yeah, with Yosha. Yeah, of course.
It was hugely antagonistic. But the second part of it, I want to say there's two aspects of this.
Yes.
It's not only that Paul, who comprises half of the Christian New Testament, his testimony is the antithesis of what God said in his Torah. But beyond that, Paul overtly attacks Yahweh, demeans him, criticizes him, negates his testimony, says that he can't save anyone. And so you have to wonder, if you're a Christian, this is the first half of it. What kind of character would a God have to have for the testimony that he personally dictated to Moshe, that he etched in stone, that he spoke to his own children with his own voice, to have all of that be a lie? And then you think that a God would be reliable, would be trustworthy, when he inspires somebody else later to negate everything that he said and to come up with an entirely different plan?
Not just somebody else with extensive religious training, something he railed against, okay?
Correct, yes. Now, the second thing is...
And he did it in secret.
Right. Now, second thing is, if the testimony, the foundational testimony of God, we're reading Bereshith Genesis, God's creation account, the story of the flood, up to the formation of the covenant with Abraham. God's foundational testimony, including the promised land, including retrieving the children from the crucible of Egypt, which was from religious and political oppression, bringing them back into the promised land. If what God had to say to us in his Torah isn't reliable, cannot be trusted, what kind of a moron would trust him when he comes up with plan B? If plan A isn't reliable, why would Plan B be reliable? If the old covenant isn't useful, what on earth would make anybody who is the least bit rational think that the new covenant, which contradicts the old covenant, would be rational?
Well, it's the counterfeit is pretty clever. I just want to look at Yao Kanan 117 real quick, very quickly. Yeah. This is what it actually says on a pre-Constantine parchment. So this is the oldest we have of it. Mm-hmm. For the reason the Torah, through Moshe, was given, acceptance and truth through the Messiah, Yahusha, came to exist. Now here's what the Bible version says. For the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by way of Jesus Christ. They do not say the same thing. Yao Kanan that credits the acceptance of the Torah with the very existence of Yahusha.
Yeah, and what is Yao Kanan? Well, Yao Kanan is a name based on a name and a verb, right?
Yahweh is merciful.
Yes, yeah. Yahweh. It's Yahweh Kanan. Kanan means merciful. And so do you think that a fellow named Yahweh is merciful, Yao Kanan, is going to write grace when his name is based on the Hebrew word for mercy? Kanan?
No.
Zero.
And not only that, grace is
zero
grace,
chance.
Of course, comes from a pagan god.
Of course.
And
not just, and by the way, the graces are not just any pagan goddesses. The Gratia in Rome were modeled after the charities, the Charis in Greece. They are the epitome of paganism. You know, in almost all pagan religions, you have temptresses and temple prostitutes and nude forms that are designed to make the religion seductive and enticing. Well, these are the gods, goddesses of
naked.
These are right. They're always depicted naked. They're always very attractive. They were the favorite goddesses of most Greeks and Romans. If you go into an old Greek or Roman home or community that has been preserved, like Ephesus or Herculaneum or Pompeii, and you look at the frescoes on the walls of homes and public buildings, the single most common presentation of a god or goddess are the gratia or the graces or the charis or charities, because they symbolized everything that is rotten with religion, but everything that makes religion so enticing.
Well, their naked form stands in front of the entrance of the Acropolis in Athens.
Correct.
Today.
Correct.
So.
Correct. And so,
you think
that God is going to say, I don't want you proclaiming the names of pagan goddesses and gods, and I don't want you chasing after them. And then he's going to negate his Torah teaching in this regard by basing his plan of salvation not on a relationship, but instead upon the name of these goddesses.
And what does Yahweh call his words? He doesn't call them a Bible. He calls them his words, doesn't he?
Yes. He uses the bar.
Surely a person who proclaims a message on behalf of a deity who oversteps their bounds to speak words in my name, which I have not instructed nor directed him to speak, and who speaks in the name of other gods, indeed that prophet shall die. Now, a prophet's anybody that claims to speak on behalf of Yahweh. They don't have to write anything down.
Right. Although,
Paul claimed to speak on behalf of Yahweh.
Paul gave two prophecies. Both of his prophecies were wrong.
Yeah.
Prophecy one. Yeah. Well, the first was that he predicted a shipwreck that did not occur. So he was on this ship and he said, this is what's going to happen to us. And everything that he predicted did not occur. The second was his most infamous failure. Paul uses the term harpazo, which is a vicious snatching away. It's associated with wolves by Yahusha. Harpazo is used by Yahusha to condemn Paul, and it's harpazo is the word that is changed to rapture in English Bibles. This vicious snatching away, and what Paul says is that he writes that he will be here to experience the rapture. So he speaks of the rapture occurring during his lifetime. That's what he predicts.
That's right.
And he was wrong. Yeah. He was wrong. He made two predictions. He got both of them wrong. And what's Yahweh's great? There's two places in Devarim. I believe it's 13 and 18, the 13th chapter and the 18th chapter, where Yahweh delineates the way that you go about recognizing whether or not someone was speaking for God or not. And one of the two has a criterion that says if he says something, predicting something that's going to occur, and it does not occur as he predicted, then he is a false prophet. He is deadly.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, that was Dabarim 18:20, and right after the, right when he's talking about these false prophets with false predictions, he's talking about these false prophets that puts the names of pagan gods in his mouth,
right,
or in his words.
Kind of go back to the Christian response, just in the big picture here, if you are a Christian or you know a Christian, you have to ask them, how is it even remotely possible that a God whose testimony cannot be trusted can be trusted when he comes up with an entirely different plan? And the Torah is God's plan of salvation. He declares it as his plan of salvation. Paul and Christianity say that it can't save anyone, has never saved anyone, but that they were inspired by the same God to present an entirely different plan of salvation. Why would anyone in their right mind trust that? Got to be stupid. That's like the guy, if you're at a street corner, and the guy at the street corner, he's a crossing guard, and says, you ought to go across the street now, and the first 10 people to go across the street are run over by a truck. And then he says, oh, by the next 10 people, you go across the street now, they're all run over by a truck. And then he tells the next 10 people to go across the street. Are you going to trust him? He says, I got a different plan. This time when you go across the street, I want you to start with your right foot, not your left foot. And you're going to trust him?
No.
I mean, that is unbelievably stupid. And then think of the character, the nature of a God who would inspire someone to contradict him. And not only to do so, but as you said, to take a person who was trained to be religious, something that he railed against, to secretly concoct a story that is wholly contradictory. Welcome back to Shattering Us, the Creator God of the universe, the fellow that had the ability to calculate the amount of energy that had to be input into the system to create the universe that could host and harbor life. The architect of that life, the individual fellow that conceived DNA as a language to literally author life. The individual who wrote the most brilliant book ever provided, the most enlightening book ever written in the Torah. The only individual to provide thousands of prophecies and get every single one right. He has a pretty good track record, both in terms of ability to communicate, ability to do what he says, consistently himself walking the walk that he himself talks, and of performing as advertised. He wrote this relative to his covenant, and this is where we've been the last 2 days, and we'll probably actually move to another statement today, but I'd like to repeat what he had to say. I want to consistently do great things with your name, causing it to genuinely exist as a blessed gift. Now, these words were comprised. The first is Gadol. We analyzed Gadol on previous shows, which is, I have chosen to continually nurture and magnify, desiring to raise your children. I want to see these children grow. I want to empower them, magnify them, increase them. So it's a term speaking of of children. It's a term speaking of raising and nurturing, which is what a father does with his children, and that's therefore speaking of the covenant. And then with your name. Well, this fellow's name was Abram. He changed his name to Abraham. And so we have to understand, well, what does Abraham mean? And we spent two shows discussing that, which means that it's the father who is merciful, who is uplifting, who is empowering and enriching. That's what Abraham means. Causing it to genuinely exist, Haya. Haya is the verb that is the basis of a fairly important name.
Yeah,
that's right. Mm-hmm. Haya tells us not only how to pronounce three of the four letters in Yahweh's name, Haya. There's no question as to how Haya is pronounced as a verb. Yahweh tells us that this verb explains his name, that his name is based on this verb. Ihaya, Asher Ihaya, which means I am who I am. I was, I am, and I will be, beneficially and relationally, who I was, am, and will be. In other words, I exist.
Exactly right.
Yeah, Haya just means exists, but the interesting thing about Hebrew, which is why Hebrew is the only language that can be used to precisely communicate the things of God. That doesn't mean we can't talk about what God said in English. We can. But the moment we move from Hebrew to English, we lose something in the translation. And what we lose is that every Hebrew verb is defined by its stem, by its mood, and by its conjugation. And in this particular case, we also have to, in fact, in every case, we have to recognize that it is only Hebrew where verbs exist. There is not a single verb that is stuck in time. There is no past, present, or future tense. All verbs are forever true. The verbs in Hebrew, therefore, are identical to light, which Yahweh says is equivalent to his nature. On a photon of light, time exists. The past, present, and future exist simultaneously. That's why God's got every prophecy right. He's not predicting the future. He's witnessed the future. And so, Haya isn't just a verb that answers the most important question that we can ask. Does God exist? God is saying, yeah, Haya. Ihaya, I exist. I have always existed. I will always exist. Which, by the way, destroys the myth of Christianity because God can't die for your sins. It also destroys the myth of this approaching day of Christmas because God can't be born. If God, Haya, as he defines his name when introducing it to us through Moshe, then he has always been, is, and will always be. Which means he cannot be born. He cannot die. He is. Extremely important to understand what the words convey. We'll even consider the stem and the mood when we return. Now, welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're considering the words that Yahweh used to convey the nature, his nature, and the nature of his covenant in Bereshit 12:2. And when we get to the second verb, which is Haya, we find that it was scribed in the call stem and the imperative mood. So what do we do? Now, first of all, before we even get to the stem and the mood, you have to deal with the fact that you cannot simply convey a Hebrew verb into a singular English tense. So, for example, causing it to genuinely exist as is present tense. So that it will exist as would be future tense. So that it has existed as would be past tense. But you see, with Hebrew verbs, when you choose one tense to restrict the thought into a particular period of time, you have robbed it of its fullness, of its actual nature, which is that this name was, is, and will exist as a blessed gift. Why could his name, before he's even named Abraham, and at this point, by the way, he's not even Abraham, he's Abram. But how is it possible that this man's name could have existed past tense? Because, well, it's not limited to past tense, it absolutely includes past tense. How is it possible that this man's name in the past could have been a blessing when it's, he doesn't even have this name yet?
Well, because Yahweh doesn't live in time, and he knew exactly what was going to happen there.
I think there's more to it than that. I think the answer here is that Abraham, while the name is used to describe this individual, the name was chosen as a symbol of Yahweh.
Well, yeah, of course.
Yahweh is the Abraham.
Sure.
He is the Father who is merciful, the Father who is enriching, the Father who is empowering, the Father who is uplifting. Yahweh is those things, and since Yahweh existence is a blessing to his covenant children, he can say it's true in the past, the present, and the future. It's because of what the name represents.
Yeah, well,
Yahweh
as
our Father
uses names to point fingers at things over and over again. You know.
Okay. Now the interesting thing here is this was written in the call stem, and that's interesting because what the call stem says is this has to be interpreted literally. The call stem forms a relationship between the subject and the object of the verb. Yahweh being the subject, the name of this individual being the object, or the name actually in this case being the subject, but the name is Yahweh's title. And the subject, is the blessing we receive. Now, what's interesting is the call stem says that in this relationship, it has to be interpreted literally. This is a genuine, literal, actual action that God is describing, which means I'm not talking by way of example here. I'm telling you, I'm literally going to make your name a blessing, a gift, something that lifts you up. Now, it was written not only in the call stem, which tells us that this needs to be interpreted and understood literally as a genuine promise, but also it was written in the imperative mood. Now, the imperative mood can do two things. On a very rare case, it is a command, but that's not the primary use of the imperative mood. The vast preponderance of the time, the imperative mood is conveyed. It is the mood of volition. In fact, if you look at any Hebrew lexicon and you look at the grammar, they will introduce the imperative mood as the mood of volition. Now, there's actually a number of Hebrew moods of volition because volition can be conveyed in first, second, or third person. Now, we don't have volitional verbs in English. What volition means is that it expresses one of two things, either a desire or that something is being shared, which is subject to free will, choice. All right. The imperative is the volitional mood in second person. All right. So because name can be considered the person here, you could actually say that the name is the operative aspect of this, that he has chosen a name, that he wants the name, to provide this blessing. That we're expressing God's intent with this name. It can also be conveying, since he is talking directly to Abram, and so when you're having a first-person conversation with another individual, the other individual is the second person. And so Abram becomes the you here. And so if the volition is expressed towards Abram as the second person, because the imperative is a second person volition, then it is saying, based upon how you respond to my name, it has the capacity to bless you. But it's your response, your choice, your decision relative to the name, the Father who is merciful, enriching, empowering, and uplifting, that will determine whether or not it's a blessing for you.
Well, there's only one Father that does that. That's Yahweh.
Yeah. And our response to him makes the difference.
It's an open invitation, isn't it?
To embrace him as our Father.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't, even Yosha, when he said, he was bugged by his disciples. Okay, when we pray, what should we actually say? And throughout the Torah, God never once asked us to pray. Never once. Never once asked us to pray. Because God's far more interested in us listening to him and us observing what he had to say and then responding to him once we know who he is and understand what he's offering than just blathering on to him, to a God we don't even know. When the disciples said, come on, we really want to know how we should go about this. And what did he say? Did he say, pray to me? Jesus Christ? No.
Nope.
He said, address our Father who is in heaven. That's what this is saying. Abraham, merciful Father, enriching Father. Address him, our Father who is in heaven, our heavenly Father. Set apart. The most important concept throughout Hebrew is the idea of being set apart. Set apart is your name. What's his name? Yahweh. What's it based on? This verb, Haya. It's all being communicated right here. All you have to do is look. And you find truth that destroys religious myths. Truth that you can rely upon. Truth that is saving.
Well, one of the other things you find is consistency.
Right.
I mean, it's all of it. Once all this falls into place and you understand the invitations and Korah and all the things he's saying throughout the Torah, you end up finding that every bit of it makes sense. And the fact that the rabbis couldn't find the mercy in the Torah and it had become just this endless list of laws means they had missed the entire point. And then to have Christians say, well, okay, you missed the mercy of the Torah. Yahweh walked away from you and he came to us. And of course, we've now nullified the Torah and replaced it with the pagan goddesses of grace. These are all outrageous ideas because Yahweh's consistent from start to finish.
Yeah. And actually he's using a name here that's quite different than grace. He's saying that the blessed gift that is merciful, that provides you with the blessing is Abraham, not grace. Abraham, not Jesus, not Christ, not the Lord. Abraham, because the moment you come to understand that God is our heavenly Father, the Father of the covenant, and that he saves his children, he protects his children, he's merciful to his children, you get it. That's the relationship that does away with religion. Now, this goes on to say,
you're a family, aren't you? You're being adopted into a family,
correct,
which has nothing to do with religion, last I checked.
Right. I mean, and, like this Christian pastor that was giving this man that has now elected to be part of Yahweh's covenant a hard time.
Mm-hmm.
He was constantly focusing on being saved by belief in the gospel of grace. He's no issue, no encouragement whatsoever to know who God is. No issue whatsoever on participating in a relationship with him. It's just Are you saved through belief in this gospel of grace?
You ever watch any of these movies with the Greek gods and all that?
Yeah,
you know, occasionally.
Yeah, sure.
And of course, people look at them and they go, wow, these people were ridiculous.
Yeah, of course.
And the, well, what is Christianity?
It's the same thing.
It's the same thing.
Yeah. It's the exact same thing. In fact, we can get to that in a moment. But the communication here is that the source of our mercy is understanding of merciful Father, which says that if you want to be saved, if you want the mercy means that you're provided a favor that you did not deserve. That's why salvation is equated with God's chanan, his mercy. But here it has been conveyed in a familial setting where it's the appreciation of God acting as our Father. He's only the Father of the covenant. And so if you're not a participant in the covenant, he's not your Father, which means you don't benefit from his mercy. You don't get the benefit of the blessed gift. In Christianity, everyone is saved by believing something that's pagan. And if they want to get to know God, they can, but there's no teaching on God because they want to ignore all the books that where God introduces himself to us. God takes a different approach. Come to know me. Participate in my family, and then I will save you. The last word in this statement is Baraka. Baraka is a derivative of Barak. Barak is one of the verbs that Yahweh uses early and often in his Torah. Baraka presents Yahweh as a father getting down on his knees in love to lift up his children. And so it is a profound term. In this case, it is a blessed and generous gift. It's a blessing and treaty which brings peace between parties engaged in a relationship, an oath and vow which promotes prosperity, the source of something sought after, and the manifestation of a gift. It's depicted as someone kneeling down in love to lift another up. It's a term that really lies at the heart of the merciful Father, the uplifting Father, the Abraham throughout the presentation of the Torah. It may be among the most misunderstood concepts in the whole of the Torah. It is the most relational and the least religious concept possible in the Torah, because Barak primarily means to kneel down. And so, since this is depicted in Yahweh's voice, it is God on his knees, God kneeling down. And, you know, that's so difficult for religious people to understand, because they want to get on their knees to lift God up when God says, no, that's not the way it works. First of all, you can't do that. You can't lift me up. And second, I don't want you on my on your knees. I want to have a relationship with you. I want to walk with you, explore with you, talk with you, hug you. I want to get down on my knees to lift you up because, A, I can do it. You know, I really have the ability to lift you up. You don't have the ability to lift me up. So, A, it's productive. And, B, our role is I'm the dad. Dads get down on their knees to lift up their children. You aren't the dad. You're the kid. Enjoy the benefit.
We don't even have the ability to lift ourselves up.
Well, this is absolutely true. And from a spiritual point of view, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, well, I'm talking about to being amplified into the next realm.
Right.
I don't know how to amplify myself to the 10th power. I don't know how to do it.
No.
I know Yahweh knows how to do it, and I know how he will do it for me. It's by me staying on his path. The one that he blazed, the one that he takes the beating for, the one that he ransomed my soul for, you know, his path, the one he cleared.
The reason you use tenfold power is because when you get to the fourth of these invitations that Yahweh has already fulfilled, because they enable the covenant's promises. So it's Pesach, which provides eternal life, Matzah, which removes the fungus of sin from our souls so we appear perfect in God's eyes. Bukutim, which is firstborn children, which is our adoption into Yahweh's family. But then you were speaking specifically of the result of those first three. Those who observe the first three are rewarded with the promise of the Shabbat, the promise of seven, which is Shavua, and they received a tenfold enrichment, a tenfold empowerment, using God's terminology. And so it's a magnitude of empowerment and enrichment. The enrichment is his teaching, his guidance. The empowerment is his spirit. And that's the benefit of these things. And yes, we can't do that for ourselves, but he is absolutely willing to do it for us. And the majesty of this, the beauty of this, the simplicity of this, just the loving and merciful nature of this may well be the central theme of the book.
It takes mercy. It takes a lot of mercy for somebody, for any being as intelligent and as powerful as Yahweh, to go out of his way to diminish himself, to be humiliated at the hands of his own creation.
Right.
To do this in order to have a relationship with the likes of me or you.
Correct.
It's incredible mercy. It's beyond belief mercy.
And to think that God is going to do it to rectify all the wrongs of a religious and political and military-oriented world, to allow people who are prone to support their militaries, prone to be religious, prone to be political, into his home to spend eternity with him. If that were the case, if his goal was to save religious and political and militaristic people, then wouldn't heaven be exactly as bad as life here is on earth?
Yes.
There's no way a father does that. A father wants to rid his home of those troubling influences, which is why the relationship comes before salvation. And no one is saved unless they're a participant.